the journey towards the cross is not one where followers expected it to go how they planned. But through their own suffering and through Jesus' suffering and even his death, God was forming a hope that at its core would not quit. A hope that could not be put to death, a hope that could not be silenced, but a hope that would endure of everyone that would allow it to.
That's the Reverend Danny Liebarger. And today he brings you a message entitled Hope That Doesn't Quit. I'm Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to episode 4186 of Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. And today on Day One, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Danny Liebarger, founding and lead pastor of The Well, a thriving United Methodist congregation in Weldon Spring, Missouri. Danny's ministry is rooted in compassion, curiosity, and deep theological reflection, especially for those navigating the space between faith, doubt, and deconstruction. Danny, thank you so much for being on Day One. Welcome. We're so glad to have you.
Yeah, excited to be here.
Okay, so you are the founding pastor of The Well, and you are in Missouri. I always am, as a Midwesterner, careful to say. Do you make a distinction about the pronunciation?
Yeah, so if you're like in St. Louis or Kansas City, you're in Missouri. But if you're in anywhere else, you're in Missouri.
I love that. Tell us about your ministry context and where you're planted now.
Yeah, so The Well is the church I'm a pastor of. I'm the founding pastor. So I started this church in 2021. And we are in kind of an interesting location in the sense that we are in a pretty conservative area. I would call it a red area. And we are a pretty progressive church. So we often refer to ourselves as a blueberry and tomato soup. And we were started here out of a desire to kind of create a progressive outlet in an area that has not often seen as a place that has that community, but certainly does. But I would also say our church engages people that are politically conservative and progressive, people that are pro-LGBTQ plus and that aren't. And so we try to be a church that's unapologetically inclusive in our context and progressive in our context, but really believes in our mantra, which is your seat at the table can't cost someone else theirs. And we try to live that in everything that we do.
Love that. And you come from a patchwork of areas in the country. Where all has your ministry taken you?
Yeah, so originally born in Los Angeles and then grew up in Portland, Oregon, where I went to high school and went to college. Started seminary at Fuller Seminary, which is in California, but then took my first pastoral job in a small little rural town in Alabama. And so if you can imagine going from like Portland, Oregon to a small town in Alabama at a non-denominational church, but they were like Southern Baptist more or less. And so coming from no real religious experience outside of working in churches, like I found Jesus in college and then started working in churches. And so I was kind of under the impression that everyone was like the church I was at in Portland. And then I go to Alabama and it was very different. Like we were having conversations about women in ministry and women pastors. I remember I quoted a Rob Bell book one time and people were ready to send me straight to hell. I mean, it was a very different experience. And I'll be honest with you, like, and this has nothing to do with them being more conservative necessarily, but it wasn't the most life-giving to me. So I left that church and moved back to Oregon thinking that I wouldn't work in churches anymore. And so I ran a nonprofit that did homeless ministry for like 5 years.
Wow.
And then dipped back in to youth ministry while I was in Portland. And then from there, found my way to St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I am now. I worked at a mega church for a while that was inclusive. It was the first really inclusive church and one of the only growing inclusive mega churches out there, at least at the time when I was there. And then started The Well in 2021. So I've kind of had a smattering of different churches from evangelicals to Baptist. Now I'm a United Methodist ordained clergy person. So have that as where I'm at. So it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah. Well, that makes even more sense with
when I first met you, so you and I met each other, we are both in a fellowship called Sinai and Synapses, which is a fellowship that brings together scientists, clergy, and writers from different faith perspectives to talk about the intersections of science and religion. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But you introduced yourself to the group, this was, I don't know, earlier this year, and you said you often feel too Christian for non-Christians and too liberal for the evangelicals. And so please unpack that, because I immediately got this sense of like, this guy has lived in a bunch of different places and has clashed and melded and all kinds of things. So do tell.
Yeah. So I'm an Enneagram 8, if you know anything about the Enneagram. And so
I love Enneagram so much. Oh, don't start. Oh, yes, keep going.
I'm a big challenger, but I would like to say I'm a nice 8 is what I try to tell people. But I always want to defend the people that feel voiceless. And so I remember when I was in seminary or undergrad, I was in a Bible class and there was a book we were reading. It was called The Meaning of Jesus. And it was written by two people, Marcus Borg and N.T. Wright. And we had to choose someone to defend. And everyone chose N.T. Wright, who I was like, I dig N.T. Wright. But no one was helping my man Borg out. And so I said, I'm going to defend this guy. And this was the first time I really like defended a more progressive view. I wasn't really brought into Christianity from a progressive perspective, but it was interesting to argue for him. And so that was a moment that I realized, like, I always want to be the counter to whatever the norm of the room is. Now I have certain non-negotiables. Like I believe that in full inclusion within the context of my church of women and queer people and people of color. And I advocate and push for that. But on my staff even, like, they're far more progressive than I am. And so I find myself trying to kind of play the middle or pull people back, because I think that there is much more fruit to be had. Even like this passage that we're looking at with Romans of like being uncomfortable and finding ourselves in tense moments and things not going the way we expected, like creating some of those moments for the sake of growth is helpful. And so all that to say, like, I've often found myself in situations where I go to church planting conferences and they love me until they find out where I stand on women in ministry or LGBTQ plus inclusion, then I'm immediately kicked out of the collective. Or I go to places with unchurched people. A lot of my friends are unchurched. Or I go to these spaces where I'm with unchurched people. I was on a Jubilee video where I was with people that were a bunch of Christians and there was an atheist in the middle of the room. And I was having that conversation with them. And I was in the room and I was like, man, I'm like not Christian enough for all of my Christian friends. But then I was too Christian for the atheist who I felt like I agreed with on most things. And so I often find myself like being in these tense moments on the opposite side of people that I feel like I'm allies for. I'm a pretty big influence on TikTok with the queer community. And oftentimes like queer individuals will hop on and be like, hey, we love this thing you're advocating for, but we're not ready to really support you until you give up on Jesus, because Jesus is X, Y, or Z thing, right? And then there's Christians like, hey, we love that your church is growing and thriving, but like, you have a woman as your worship pastor, or you have queer people on your leadership team or as your pastors. And so they'll get on that side, right? And so I just always find myself in this constant tension. And as an 8, doesn't bother me at all. But I always feel like I'm stuck and I'm not enough for anyone on any side.
Oh, as a 7, I would die inside all the time. Like, that's so generative and helpful, though, that you are able to stay in those points of tension. And what a time that you are being a human, this time of division that we are living through. So I have to say, like, you also, you co-host the Deconstruction Zone. And if I have it right, that's a podcast that explores faith, doubt, and spiritual growth. Love that. And I noticed one of your episodes was titled Politics Suck. I don't hear you saying necessarily gravitate to tension, but that you're comfortable with it, or you look for what's generative about the other side in any situation. So given all that, how you feeling about politics these days?
Yeah, well, I think they're very...
Not which politics you have, but political division in general.
Yeah, well, so I think it's a massively divisive topic. And you and I in our fellowship, we actually had an opportunity to talk with someone who's in pretty profound work in political depolarization, something that if I wasn't working in the church, I think I would try to draw myself that way. And what I don't mean by that is like, and I tell this to people all the time, like, I work really hard to create space for everyone, but I also have deeply held convictions. And so there are things that I think I am supremely right on, and I think other people are supremely wrong about. But I don't always feel like my role as a pastor or even in political settings is to convince people to think what I think. But I want to create space to hear what they think. And this episode of Politics Sucks and a lot of other things that we've done in the podcast is not to say like that politics are bad. That wasn't necessarily what we were saying. But like the tribalism and the division and the polarization is what sucks, because you get people on both sides that deeply care about something. Now, I think they bought far too much into identity politics, and that's oftentimes what leads people astray. And if I can share an example, like at our church, The Well, like one of our first Sundays that we got going, there was someone decked out in head-to-toe Make America Great Again gear and Make Missouri Great Again gear. And so very clearly what team they were on politically. And that was fine. They came to The Well. I was very happy they were there. They had a seat at the table for certain. And they ended up sitting next to like a very out, proud lesbian couple that was like not hiding who they were. Beautiful is just an image to look at in general, because no other place in church would they probably sit next to each other.
Yeah.
But what happened is they, over the course of weeks and months and years, built a friendship. And I don't know that they voted differently. I don't know that they changed anything about their politics. But what they grew in was empathy. And what they grew in is understanding. And I'm watching this couple that probably would have voted for someone to not have the right to be married, hanging out with a couple that's trying to have the right to get married, but going to get brunch together and finding similarities and commonalities and common ground. And I think if the church can do anything, like that is what I hope the church can do, is to be rooted in the person and the power of Jesus, certainly. Like we wholeheartedly believe that. But I believe the transformational power of Jesus is more about like breaking down walls than making like our tribe win the war. You know, like I think Jesus has something far more interesting in mind. And it looks a lot more inclusive than I think we often are told it can be or has to be.
And that really happened. Like, really, they became friends and really they went to brunch together?
Yeah, they went to a fundraiser together. I was talking to him maybe like, we'll say 6 months ago. And I was like, you guys are still kicking it. You're doing this thing. Like, it blows my mind. And this is now like 3 years later, right?
Wow. That is incredibly hopeful. Like just that image. Like I'm gonna walk around with that image.
Yeah. And you have to imagine like things have only gotten worse politically since then, right? And so they've had tensions that they've had to manage. But what I've appreciated is they've had the conversation. So one thing that they've been able to do is through cultivated trust, have a conversation to say like, you know what? I don't really feel seen or heard by you when you do these things. Or you know what? I don't believe in this aspect of your lifestyle, and this is why. And maybe it's based in upbringing or bias, or I firmly believe that this is what Jesus would want. But how often do we ever put ourselves in those situations? Like as an eight, I often seek them out, but I know that's like not the normal mode of operation for most of us.
Right. Oh, I love you, eights. You win a lot too.
We win a lot, but we also break a lot of things in the process, which is like, we try not to do that.
Oh, I love it. Okay, Danny, I sometimes there's like questions and times on this show that I am dying to ask people what their Enneagram is. But since you've brought it up, now I have permission, but we need to give people a little primer about what Enneagram is. So I'm going to start and you help me clean up. So Enneagram is a personality typing system like there are so many in the world. And how would you finish it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it helps. For me, it's different than all the other ones because it is in many ways rooted in some of my weaknesses or flaws. But I actually think that it's inherently far more hopeful than that. So people stay away from it because it looks really dark. And so like if you're an eight, like you might be power hungry, you might be domineering, and you see that like, well, I don't want to classify myself as that. But when I look at it, I see some of the pitfalls for areas that I could lead poorly. And it tells me what I would look like if I led really healthily. And so like things like Strength Finders, also a huge nerd of Strength Finders, but it only tells me the things I'm good at. Like I want to know the pitfalls and the things I'm bad at. And so I've really enjoyed it because it's given me kind of what I think is deeply spiritual language for leadership conversations about how to be the person God created me to be in some of the areas that I try to avoid, but also the areas I can leverage to be the actual person God created me to be.
Beautifully put. Enneagram is not something you have to pay for either. You can just go online. No, there is not a perfect test. There are tests to help you. But that's the other thing I love about Enneagram is that it's the kind of thing you need to do with others because you read about the personality types and then you look at it alongside other personality types and you have people who know you help you figure out which one you are. I love that part too.
Yeah. And Richard Rohr has some of the best stuff on it. So if you're looking
Absolutely.
For like anywhere to go, if you just go, I think it's the Enneagram Institute. Richard Rohr's stuff is really great.
Yep. Richard Rohr, an amazing Christian theologian also. So yeah, all sorts of ways to enter the Enneagram. Now I have an excuse to talk about Enneagram more. Fantastic.
Happy to help.
Now, listen for God's word as we hear from the letter to the Romans, chapter 5, verses 1 through 5.
Therefore, since we have been made righteous through his faithfulness, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. We have access by faith into this grace in which we stand through him, and we boast in the hope of God's glory. But not only that, we take pride in our problems, because we know that the trouble produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope. This hope doesn't put us to shame, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us.
Now, Reverend Danny Leiberger's sermon entitled, Hope That Doesn't Quit.
So last week I had a great opportunity, one that I will cherish forever, which was attending the Frozen Four National Championship for hockey here in St. Louis, where me and my family live. My son, massive hockey fan, something that he's been looking forward to. But even more than that, he is a massive Boston University fan. And so when we got the opportunity to go to this hockey game, he was beyond excited. We went through the fan fest and he was high-fiving everyone that was around him, every Boston University fan that he could find. He was chest bumping and congratulating and getting the opportunity to build camaraderie and connect with. And so as we went from this fan fest into the game, my son's excitement continued and continued to build. It got so much to the point where his smile was exploding off of his face. But what I did not know and did not plan was where we bought our tickets. I went on to StubHub and I got the cheapest tickets I could find in the best section that I could find. But what I didn't realize was that I had placed my son and I right in the heart of the Western Michigan University fan section or student section. So the opposing section of what my son was hoping to be in. And as we walked up, I watched the realization hit his face as we went up the stairs and he saw Broncos uniforms everywhere, not a piece of red in sight. He was terrified and he was frustrated. He was nervous about what was going to happen as his expectations shifted. And it was pretty fun. Like, we got up there and we got to stand next to some people and the fans did their whole chants and they did all these things. And initially he was, again, taken aback. He was frustrated. He was kind of terrified of what it was. We even talked about what would happen if we went and sat somewhere else. But what unexpected happened to me and happened to him is I watched his fear, his trepidation, his uncertainty about how this event would go start to shift as he ingratiated himself to the community around him. He connected with Western Michigan fans. They continued to say they wanted to win him over and they wanted him to become a future Bronco, even though he still clung to his BU fandom. And at the end of it, again, I think they won him over. I remember he leaned over to the person next to him, a Western Michigan senior who had waited his whole life to watch them win the national championship. And eventually they won this game. And my son, who's sad with his own sadness about Boston losing, leaned over and put his shoulder on this guy or his arm on this guy's shoulder and said, "Hey, man, I just want you to know that I am really happy for you." And that level of empathy, at least in terms of being a dad, was the most proud dad moment that I've had. But it taught me something in that moment about the importance of allowing ourselves to have shifted expectations. And so as we think about like what we're talking about today and what we're unpacking today, it kind of sits in that. Like, what if things aren't what we expected? What if they don't go exactly the way we've expected them to be or what we thought we needed them to be? And sometimes, and I might argue specifically for my son, but in terms of our faith life, that sometimes the real gift isn't in things going our way, but it's what's formed in us as they don't go our way. And what I think is quite wonderful about this passage from Romans is that it leads perfectly into this. This is where the Apostle Paul is writing to a young and kind of struggling group of Jesus followers. The church is coming up. It's starting to thrive, maybe, but still kind of stumbling along the way. And it's in the shadows of this oppressive Roman Empire that is kind of lording itself over there. And these are people that are trying to hold on to a hope in a world that is full of pressure, that's full of persecution, that's full of uncertainty, that expectations maybe look different than what they thought a life following Jesus would look like in their context. And Paul, he just spent the first four chapters of Romans laying out how grace, not rule following or pedigree, is what puts us right with God and in relationship with God. And here in chapter 5, Paul starts describing what life actually looks like for people who have been made right by that grace. People like us, people like you, people like me, people still living in the world where things don't always line up the way that we expect them to be or we hope them to be. And this is the first thing he says to them. Essentially, he says, it's going to be hard, but even that's not going to be the end of the story. And when I think about this, like, we live in a world of toxic lots of things. And in my context, oftentimes I'm very positive. I have a staff of people at my church, The Well, and they often tell me that I'm overly positive. And when I look at Paul here, I don't see him trying to sell some level of toxic positivity or blind optimism. I actually think he's showing us a path through adversity that forms us, that through suffering, we grow into things like endurance. And as we grow in our endurance, it leads us to develop things like character. Character is often something that we don't see when things are going well, but we see when things are going not as we expected and not as we planned. It's one of my favorite things about the character of God, that the character of God is best displayed in some of the low moments, for certain in the high moments, but often we see God's character more clearly in the low moments, and that suffering, endurance, and character development ultimately gives us what I think is unending and unwavering and really life-changing levels of hope. And I go back to my son at this hockey game. I don't think the game went exactly how he expected and how he wanted, or certainly he didn't. I mean, watching Boston University lose and lose handedly, I think it was 6-2 by the end of the match. It didn't go how he expected or how he wanted, but he got something far richer at the other side of it, which was compassion, compassion, connection, and perspective. And what I think is quite wonderful in this is, like, he spent the entire game really nervous about how it was going to go, but spent this conversation with this young college student next to him. And they spent the entire time talking about youth hockey and officiating and things outside of what his tribe of Boston University looked like and his expectation of high-fiving his comrades would look like, and found a far different level of compassion and connection and perspective than I think he ever imagined would happen. As he walked into this game, and specifically as he walked out of it. I know that because he hugged me and said it was one of the greatest moments that he had ever had, which is a dad is the thing that you always want to hear. But when I look at him in that game, like, he never abandoned his love for BU. Like, his love for Boston University never left. He even told me, he's like, I'm still planning to go to Boston University when I go to college. But what did shift was an expanded capacity to celebrate and empathize with others. And I wonder, like, how much we actually try to do that in our life, to expand our capacity to empathize, to celebrate with people that are on the other side of the aisle from us, that are disagreeing with us, that don't think or look or act like us, that don't believe the things that we believe, don't root for the same teams that we root for. Like, how do we celebrate and empathize with people that we've often villainized? And I think that is born out of a resilient kind of hope, one that doesn't collapse under the pressure of differences of opinions, doesn't collapse under the pressure of being surrounded by people that feel like they're our enemies, but actually grows a bigger heart in the midst of that tension, which I think is exactly what Paul is talking about in this passage, that these things and these tense moments, this sort of shift in expectation and these moments that are unexpected and more tense than we thought, they don't break us, they expand us. They don't cast us to the side, but they help us become the people that God created us to be, people of hope and joy and grace in everywhere that we walk. And this is Paul in this moment, in this passage in Romans, talking to people who lost things, control, comfort, I mean, many times safety, but still reminding them that hope does not disappoint. And reminding them that as they cling to that hope, even if things don't look exactly the way that they thought they would look, that didn't go exactly the way they thought they would go, that God's hope is the common thread that is woven through the experience of not just us individually as followers of Jesus, but as the entire collection of those in the way of Jesus. And I think when I look at this story as well, God is far more invested than we think. I think we often think that God is only invested in the moments of mountaintops, in the moments of winning, in the moments of success. And I go back to that moment with Knox sitting with the senior in the Western Michigan student section. Like, that's what I think love looks like when it's poured out. When people step out of their comfort zone and out of their space into a moment and story with someone else to connect through love and grace and empathy. And I think, like, if a kid can hold on to learn to that kind of joy that transforms their own understanding of tribalism as much as it sets in at 10 years old, like, how much more important is that for us to understand that that's a part of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, to be a part of God's family, and to believe that God is forming us into something that's far bigger than ourselves, that often compels us to sit in uncomfortable seats for an opportunity to grow and experience and to be in community and relationship with people that we never imagined we could. Because I think of my son's bingo card for that day was not sitting in the Western Michigan student section. I would say certainly that. I mean, the look on his face was not just shock, but it was like, Dad, why did you do this to me? But as we walked down from the 300 level and out of the arena and to our car, like his face continued to grow in joy. His memories that he recalled even days and weeks later have continued to grow into memories that I think will be core ones for him moving forward, and core memories that I think teach him what it means to grow through adversity, to find endurance in uncomfortable situations. And for us, as we do this in our own life, even coming off Palm Sunday in my own church, I think Jesus reminds us that a journey towards the cross is not one where followers expected it to go how they planned. It didn't go exactly what they thought it was going to look like, but through their disappointment and through their own suffering and through Jesus' suffering and even his death, God was forming a hope that at its core would not quit, a hope that could not be put to death, a hope that could not be silenced, but a hope that would endure forever in the hearts, minds, souls of everyone that would allow it to. So if you're not where you expected to be in your journey, I would say you're in good company. From first century Christians to now, we have been people that have not been where we've expected to be, whether that's wandering through the wilderness or being with Paul in first century oppressed Christianity and the Roman rule, or being in 21st century Christianity here in America or abroad. It doesn't always look like what we want it to look like. We're not always sitting where we expected to sit. But in that seat, we are not alone, because we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses that have sat in the same places that we have sat, that have journeyed the same journey we've sat, and God continues to pour out and will continue to pour out the same level of love to form us into something deeper than we could ever imagine possible as this community of faith is grown and deepened together. So with that in mind, would you pray with me? God, I do thank you so much that you are a God that doesn't quit. You have a grace that doesn't give up, a grace that doesn't leave us alone, a grace that meets us even in places that feel awkward or uncomfortable and that are ultimately unexpected. And so God, for those of us that are in places that we never expected to be, I just ask that you would give us eyes to see the people you have put around us. Maybe people we didn't expect to be allies and friends, but the people you have positioned in places to help us connect more fully with you and with others and to grow into the people you are creating us to be. And so God, be with us as we continue to worship you through the moments of our week, whether that's on a walk or listening to this message or being in community and relationship with the people we expected and those we didn't expect. We know all of those are equally holy moments. And we just ask that you would draw us closer to you in all that we do. Pray this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Danny Liebarger. For a free transcript of his sermon, Hope That Doesn't Quit, you can visit us online at dayone.org. Each week, we take a moment to say thank you. This gratitude moment lifts up one of you, our faithful listeners who walk this journey with us. This week, it's our joy to uplift Nancy Zintak of Atlanta, Georgia, a faithful listener, dedicated leader, and tireless supporter of Day One for many decades. Nancy has served in just about every role as a trustee of the Alliance for Christian Media, and her commitment to this ministry has been nothing short of extraordinary. Whether it's offering strategic insight, rallying support, hosting the best get-together, or simply showing up with generosity and grace, Nancy exemplifies the spirit of faithful service. Together with her husband, John, she has given generously to sustain Day One's mission. And she's also given time, energy, and heart through countless hours of volunteer leadership. A lifelong communicator and civic leader, Nancy brings her gifts not only to Day One, but also to St. Luke's Episcopal Church and to the wider Atlanta community through her work with Central Atlanta Progress and Georgia Public Broadcasting. We suspect Nancy will hear this, as she does every Sunday at 7:05 a.m. on 95.5 WSB in Atlanta. Nancy, we love you. For 80 years, Day One has shared messages of hope and unity, bringing together Christians from all walks of life. To support this ministry, visit us online at dayone.org/donate, or mail your contribution to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia, 30319. Thank you for helping us bring light and encouragement to so many. Next week on Day One, we welcome back Reverend Juan Carlos Huertas, Minister of Proclamation and Practice of Justice at First Plymouth Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, with a powerful message entitled, "The Journey Will Be Too Much." In a time when many feel weary from the weight of the world, Huertas draws us into the story of Elijah to reflect on what happens when the fire fades and the silence speaks. It's a deeply honest, beautifully prophetic word for a church and a world still walking through the wilderness, reminding us that God still meets us there with nourishment for the journey ahead. That's next week on Day One. Danny, thank you so much for that sermon. It opened up Romans 5 in such a great way. So Paul lays out a journey that starts with suffering, ends with hope, but without skipping over the hard stuff. And so this progression, suffering, endurance, character, hope, you've shared a good bit with us. What else does it mean to you personally, Danny? Like this suffering, endurance, character, hope, progression?
Yeah, well, I certainly don't mean that I think God is punitively causing suffering. And so I think that's something that many of us can fall into is when we hear things like this. And I even thought about it as I was sharing the message that it's like, well, I hope we understand that like God is not the God with the magnifying glass burning ants. But I also know that like I think God uses those moments of suffering that are inevitably going to be happening through the brokenness of human experience to say, I am a God of resurrection. I mean, that's what we celebrate as Easter people, right? That God takes the irredeemable things and turns them into something that are stories of hope where hope looked hopeless. And so for me, I mean, I've had up into my mid-20s, had a pretty privileged life with very little suffering. And when I hit my first level of real suffering and that all came at one time, I remember looking around and being like, this is why people leave the church. This is why people isolate themselves from other people. This is why we go at it alone, because sometimes it feels like the faith we've been given is one that doesn't have scaffolding to hold up really messy things that don't have immediate answers. But when we look at suffering, it's not a pathway to direct answers, but a pathway to greater hope. And I can certainly say that now looking a decade back and saying like, God took my suffering. And I would not even say God took my suffering only, like I had a active part in navigating my own suffering along with God. And my faith has far more endurance than it ever had. Like I'm not a huge runner, my wife is, but if I use that kind of analogy, like I was the kind of Christian that could go and run a mile and I was really excited I could run a sub-6 mile. But if you had me run two, I was running like 15-minute mile paces for 2 miles. I had no endurance, right? And so I was great when things were short and in sprints, but I had no endurance. And my suffering gave me something that I never knew was important or never knew possible, which was endurance. And I would hope my character has grown, but ultimately really I look and say like, man, I have more hope now in my mid-30s as a follower of Jesus and as a husband and as a pastor, a father, all of those things than I ever had before I hit some of these pretty painful things that I had to go through. But God walked with me faithfully through those. And I think there was as much on me to walk faithfully with God in that and not throw my hands up and quit, you know?
Yeah. And those hard things that happened, they came after you had come to faith in college or before. Because for some people, it would be like, had the hard stuff, then found God.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I only really found my faith because it seemed like, I mean, I was a little bit like sad. Like I probably drank too much and I did too many things. And I was like, man, like, I need Jesus, more or less. But like I've had good mentors and I found my way in. But yeah, I mean, I didn't really experience much suffering. Like that isn't what led me to Jesus. But I had this moment of saying when I really hit it, and I think many Christians have this, pastors too, they get into it and they find affection with Jesus, but they've never really built any emotional intelligence or they've never really built any framework to handle pain and suffering. And so the first time that hits, we're like, maybe I bought a bad thing, right? I didn't actually believe in this. And I had to wrestle with that. Like, how much of what I've been preaching do I really believe? And I realized things like that I was preaching and things that I was saying were rooted in not like optimism, but rooted in a lack of real understanding of how the world works. And so I'm a far more empathetic person now because I've experienced suffering. And I think comparison is the thief of joy. And so my suffering is not yours and it's not anyone else's. But I finally experienced a level of like formative suffering that caused me to see actually greater levels of grace on the other side, for sure.
And can I ask, you said that you were, you committed yourself to a homelessness ministry there, like in a, and how did that change or grow your sense of empathy? How does that fit into the trajectory of your emotional intelligence and your growth as a pastor?
Yeah. So when I went into this ministry, I was pretty certain. So Portland, Oregon has a massive homeless population and I'm one of the biggest in the country, certainly in the Northwest. People from Washington might send people down to Portland. People from Idaho might send them to Portland on a bus. Often that would happen. And we were not a direct service provider, but we were assisting those that were. But I kind of had a framework that the best way to help people was to give them immediate solutions. And the more conversations I had, I remember sitting with a guy and we were sharing a sandwich. And I was asking him like, well, what do you really need? And how are things going? And we got to know each other over the course of my time working in this job. And he's like, do you want me to be honest with you? Or do you, like, what kind of answer? And I was like, please be honest with me. And he's like, I like need an opportunity. Like, I don't need another sandwich. Right. And that was like a big shift for me because I was big into like giving people tangible things to meet what I thought was their need. But I never really took the time to ask them what their needs were. And if you ask almost every homeless person on the street of Portland, they would say like, we know where to get a meal. We know where to get a shower. We know where to get a place to sleep. And there are people that don't find those all the time, but certainly they know where to find them. Sometimes it's more about availability than being able to know where they exist. But what they universally all expressed a desire and a need for more of was opportunity. And so what that taught me in that moment was one, like some of our systems are trying to be Band-Aids and they're not really like helping anyone in really substantive ways. But it made me ask better questions. And some people like me for this and some people don't, but I ask a lot of questions. Like I ask people more questions than I try to give answers because I want to be as curious as I can be to find out what the real issue or the real problem or the real need is. And not just as the person that I am that is often like filled with confidence and sometimes hubris and oftentimes all of it's unearned. I think I have all the answers. And so I'm like, well, maybe if I ask better questions, I can get better information to give better responses.
That just makes me think also. So you made a point of saying, you know, Paul isn't offering just this toxic positivity, but something deeper. And so how do we tell the difference between, say, like honest, real hope and then sort of sugar-coated sort of denial kind of thing? You know, how do we sort that out?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just preached a little bit about this like on Sunday at my church just the other day that when Jesus was going to the cross, there was continually more reasons to be less hopeful. By the time he's on the cross and certainly in his tomb, like there's not a lot of like hope around, right? But they still cling to it a little bit. I mean, people like Thomas aren't super into it. And even Peter, like who knows really what's going through his mind? He's like, I failed so much. I don't really get access to this hope anymore. And so he does his own thing, right? But I think there's a difference. Like naive hope is, I think, hope without action maybe, or hope without maybe any history in it. But like one of the things that they saw is that like Jesus continually overcame and Jesus continually shifted expectations. And so I think there's a level of hope that's rooted in a reality that's never existed. That's maybe a little bit naive. But like trying to root it in a reality and a promise that has existed. And like, I think we have the benefit. We know the story. Like we have all the Bible. So we get to read it and we get to
look. Right. We know how it goes.
I would have crushed it in your situation. So I don't know what I would have done, but I'm like, they watched Jesus walk on water. They watched him raise Lazarus from the dead. They watched him feed the 5,000. They watched him do all of these things. And so those that clung onto hope were not being naive. I think they were clinging on to the fact that history has continually proven in their life that Jesus shows up when the odds are continually against them. And that's the kind of hope I have tried to cling on to, is that sometimes the odds don't look in my favor, but it's not so naive because it's based in a reality and a rubric of understanding that Jesus continually shows up.
Yeah. And the defiance, and that's a part of hope, that the defiance is not naivete. The defiance is a part of what hope is. It's hope in the face of something else. It's exciting.
And think about how mad the Pharisees would have been, right? Like, that's why they were so mad, right? Because their hope was so defiant. They're like, they feel like they're stacking up W's and wins the entire, like, this is getting better for them and worse for the followers of Jesus, but they're still watching people hang on. The crowd is thinning out, but like the hopeful people, there's still a few of them. And that was the greatest act of defiance, right? It's saying we're not going to give up with hope. Yep. And to think what happens as like Jesus dies, he's resurrected, and this, they think they have squashed the movement. And now they are clinging on to a hope that is blowing people's minds, that is so defiant and so in the face of conventional logic. But they're like, we have a story greater than the one you guys decided to believe. They had the opportunity to believe it and the opportunity to see it, and sometimes did see the same things, but stood in that. And I just have to think, like, that's something I don't think about enough, is like, not everyone was Team Jesus. And what did the people think that were on the other side witnessing those following Jesus and cling to this hope? Like, what did they think? Because it would have been jarring to watch.
Yeah. And it just comes back to the main thread of what you were saying, which is you're not where you expected to be. Well, welcome to it. That really is okay. What would you say to people listening now who feel like they're sitting in the wrong seat in life? What would you want them to hear from this sermon and from your journey with this scripture?
I would challenge the idea that you're in the wrong seat. I think that would be the first thing I would say. Like, it may not be the seat you expected.
There you go.
But it might not be the wrong seat. But I would also say, like, again, our mantra at The Well is your seat at the table can't cost someone else theirs. But we don't always say that you initially find the right seat. Like, maybe there is a better seat for you. And so I think finding your place and just knowing you're there is the first and most important step. Like, sometimes we feel like we're seated alone at the kiddie table. And so maybe we're sitting at a seat and we're just not even at the right table. But I don't know. Like, I really do. It's frustrating. I've been in those positions in ministry and in life, relationally and personally and spiritually. And it's frustrating because you look around and part of it is comparison. You see people that look like they're sitting in the right seat.
Yep.
And you're like, I just want that. But again, we're not alone. And like, it's a very human experience to feel that way. And I would say sometimes if we're more authentic and raw, we'd realize how many of us feel like we're meandering and we're in the wrong seat and we're doing well.
Oh, yes.
Right. And so it's like, I wonder if we were just more vulnerable with each other, we'd realize that we're all in this together. It's one of the reasons that I love, and I don't even think it was in my sermon notes, but I referenced like the Hebrews passage of the cloud of witnesses. Like, there are people that have done this with us before, and we are not alone in our experience. But the cloud of witnesses could also be the people that are walking with us now. Like, we don't have to do this alone. And oftentimes we think we do. We have to white knuckle it, or we have to figure our calling or our purpose or any or our faith just in general on our own. And from the creation narrative of like God being present with God's self to the creation of people being in community to the growth of the church and never just being a few, but many, even if it's just three gathered together up to 3,000 in Acts, like we're doing it together. And it's never been a solo thing. Jesus even sent people out together. And sometimes we feel like we're in the wrong seat because we're just sitting alone.
So I love that you bring up about the importance of wisdom traditions. So what do you think about this thing that's where we put science next to religion and we say that there's a lot of conflict between it? What would you say to that conflict?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think religion can provide us wisdom and something of like what it means to be in diverse communities and be with people. Like, look at the first century church. It was not monolithic. And their big first initial arguments were like, how diverse are we going to allow this to be? And it continues to get more diverse, both culturally and gender-wise and all of that, right? And globally, it starts to expand. And I believe, and I think Andy Stanley maybe said this, that like the church is the hope of the world. And like, I firmly believe that, right? Like, I only do this Jesus thing and this church thing because I think it matters and has hope. If it didn't, I would be a like investment banker or something like that. I don't know. But I do this because I think it provides hope, tangible, real hope, and not potential hope, but tangible, real hope. But I think we've often been pit against each other. And this goes back to polarization in terms of like, it's us versus them. So it's my denomination. Christians are the worst too. Like, it's Presbyterians against Baptists or Methodists against whoever else, right? Like, we pit ourselves against
so
each
silly.
Other.
Yes.
And I'm working on a theory that I won't get into, but I do think that people of our age bracket were conditioned by Disney movies that banished and annihilated the villains. Go back and watch. None of them have redemption stories. They all disappear.
Yeah.
So that's what we think we do with the people that disagree with us, is they get annihilated or they disappear. And no wonder we believe in annihilationism as it relates to the afterlife, because that's the story we were told in like children's stories. And then we're like, well, our faith must be the same, right?
Good theory. Oh, yes. I like that. Actually, that has legs.
But I think like that's how we view the world. Like if you're not for me, you're against me. And more so than not being against me, you will be annihilated because you're against me. And I think religion offers us a framework that Jesus said that like, I'm going to create more seats than I take away. I'm going to sit with the person that your religious institution kicked out and your community kicked out and this person that broke your rules. I'm going to bring them together and I will certainly challenge them to go and sin no more. But one thing that Jesus never did was, and this is proved in scripture, we can't find this. He never sent a progress report to anyone he said, go and sin no more to. He never asked them how much better they were doing. He didn't ask the Pharisee and the tax collector when the tax collector left the temple, like, hey, did you stop doing all those things? Did you stop extorting people? Did you stop sinning? He just said like, this person left justified. It's a pretty big sermon from Jesus in a short little area. And I think, what does religion offer us, if not that, that Jesus transforms us outside of our own personal experience, but also transforms the way we interact with the world around us in ways that look more just, inclusive, loving, and kind. And like, that's the Jesus I want to follow and the religion I want to be a part of. And if that's not what religion's offering us, I'm not that interested in being a part of it, if I'm being super honest.
Amen. Danny, keep on bringing the kind of unapologetic hope that you so clearly bring to the world. Keep on bringing it. You certainly have brought it today, and we're so grateful for it.
Yeah, thank you. This has been fun to get to be a part of.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays, and we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Kime. May the grace of God be with you on day one and every day yet to come.